Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Adam Harris, the assistant social editor at ProPublica. Can algorithms be biased? A team of reporters led by ProPublica senior reporter Julia Angwin found that one algorithm used to predict future criminals often made mistakes for both white and black defendants, but in very different ways. Today we speak with Julia about her investigation into algorithmic bias and how it manifests itself in the criminal justice system. Welcome to the show, Julia.
It's great to be here.
We're going to go back to start. What made you want to investigate algorithms, of all things?
That's a great question. I have been covering technology and privacy and surveillance for years now, and I started thinking about the fact that people just don't really care about privacy. They know that their data is going somewhere, but they don't know what's being done with it. And so I thought, you know, if I start focusing on what's actually being done with data, which is using it in algorithms to make guesses and judgments about you, maybe people might care about this issue. So that's what led me to start looking into algorithms.
And for this project specifically, how did you get to machine bias?
Basically, once I decided that I wanted to start looking at algorithms, I thought, well, what can I do that hasn't been done? I always take a very tech approach to things. So I thought, well, I want to try to reverse engineer some algorithms. I want to see some black boxes that are out there that are making decisions and see if I can figure out why they're making them. And often I won't be able to tell why, but who's being harmed by the way those decisions are being played out. And honestly, my first foray into this was all over the place. I was looking at whether you might get different airline prices. You know how whenever you're looking online for an airline price, you just know you're kind of being screwed, but you can't figure out how. And it seems like you check the price again an hour later and it's gone up. And, you know, and so I did a lot of testing of those kinds of algorithms before I ended up in the criminal justice system.
And so when you say black boxes, what does that mean?
So black boxes is sort of a way of describing an algorithm that you can't understand the workings of. So essentially, the classic black box actually comes from the airplane, right, which tells you the flight path and all that. But essentially, it's about the idea that, you know, when you do a Google search, you can't really tell why certain things come up on top. And like plenty of people have tried to figure out and game that system, but in the end, only Google has the secret formula. It's like the secret formula for Coke. And so those algorithms that make those kinds of decisions are often referred to as black boxes because you can't really tell how the exact way that they make their decisions.
So you were looking at these airline prices. When did you hit a wall in that line of reporting?
I was down a whole bunch of roads simultaneously. So I was looking at airline prices. I was looking at online prices for other things. I was actually filing a bunch of FOIAs on employment law and looking into the algorithms that people use to make hiring decisions. I was failing mostly at most of them, to be honest. And it was kind of depressing. There was a point at which we've been running tests on prices online to see whether you get different prices if you shop from your phone or from a desktop computer, or maybe the difference between an iPhone and an Android phone. And we were looking at that for months. We had months worth of data and found like literally no results. And it was very sad.
So after all of those months, what's the moment where you were like, man, we really need to look at, you know, this algorithm and how they're using it in sentencing? And where did this story come?
So this story came because I was doing all those tests, but simultaneously I was thinking, what are the highest stakes algorithms I could find, right? Even if you get a bad airline price, it's not the end of the world, right? And so when I was looking around to figure out what were the highest stakes algorithms out there, I stumbled on this industry of risk assessment scores. And I thought, this is weird. These are these algorithms used in the courtroom. And then I started looking into the literature, and it did not seem as though people had really been testing them. And then I stumbled on Eric Holder's letter where he asked the Sentencing Commission to study them for racial bias, and I saw that nothing had happened since then. And so while all these tests were running and I was having sad outcomes, I also was looking into where we might be able to test these algorithms. And my researcher, Lauren, I asked her to spend some time looking where what states were using it and where might we be able to get a data set, because I knew that for the way to tell this story was to have the actual data. Plenty of people had written sort of think pieces about these algorithms and whether they might be biased. And so obviously the next thing to do was actually to prove it.
And so what do people think of as the benefit of these algorithms?
These algorithms are actually created and designed and marketed and used with the best of intentions. So the people pushing risk assessment scores are part of criminal justice reform movement, really seeking to take bias out of the industry. The working assumption is that the whole criminal justice system is sort of structurally biased, and that each human making a decision may well be just looking at a person who's of a different color and judging them to be more dangerous than they are. And so there was this idea that if we brought objective science into the courtroom, we could remove that bias. And so the people who built these tools really believe that they can remove that bias. And they also believe, by the way, that they should be used to give people who are deemed high risk better treatment. So the idea is that there would be no punishment for being seen as high risk, that in fact, we would just learn that you have a lot of needs, such as vocational job training and mental health counseling and drug treatment, and that people rated as high risk would actually go into treatment programs, and that it wouldn't hurt them in any way to be deemed high risk. And that's how these were all designed.
Okay, so you have the idea for, you know, you're going to look at risk scores. Lauren's researching. She's seeing, you know, what states have it. At what point do you start digging in more? Like, after she's giving you all these results, where do you start looking after that?
So the thing that I realized very quickly was that there were dozens of risk scores out there, and all of them were homegrown. So homegrown solutions where various states had built their own risk scores. And so I quickly realized this was a very disparate field, and it was going to be hard to test it, because if you just tested one very local flavor of risk score, it might not have national implications. But I learned that there were two nationwide commercial software vendors selling these scores. And so I thought that would be a better one to test. There was Compass and LSI, and Compass Northpoint is the one that we settled on testing. But they are the two for-profit companies in this space. So to me, it made sense to focus on them.
So take us to your first reporting trip. So you've gathered a good amount of data. When you're going on your first reporting trip to Florida, what is that like?
So we had gotten the data from Florida through Freedom of Information Act requests. So by the time I went to Florida, I already had data in hand, right? And I had been reading criminal records of people in Broward County, Florida for months. So when I arrived there, I kind of felt like I knew what was happening. But of course, what happens when you land on the scene is you always realize you have no idea what's happening. So when I sat down with the public defenders who represent clients in the courtroom, they actually said, well, we never heard of these risk scores. We didn't know they were being used in our courtroom. And I was like, what? So then I was shocked, and I talked to them about it, and I promised to tell them everything I knew about it. Then I went and talked to the Broward Sheriff's Office. They're the ones who administer the score. So they do the risk score when people come into jail. They ask them a bunch of questions when they're booked for an arrest. I spent a lot of time with them talking to them about the score. And once again, I realized that I had no real understanding of how it was administered. Like, who asked these questions and what was it like? So I sat down with the woman who actually did the questions. And they wouldn't let me sit in. I wanted to sit in on an assessment to see how it happened. But they told me that they actually told me it was just too dangerous for me to go into jail. I've been in other jails, and I feel like it was going to be fine. But I don't know, maybe Broward County is really dangerous. And one thing I hadn't realized when I was in Broward County also was that they had started this program kind of under duress. They have been under a federal consent decree for jail overcrowding for 40 years. So they are the longest monitored jail in the country, apparently. They have had lawsuit from inmates in the 70s alleging overcrowding and mistreatment, and they've never actually been able to lift that order because there constantly have been new crises and new overcrowding. And so they really needed a solution to put fewer people in jail. And so I realized that this is one way that they could do that, because politically it gives you cover. If you can say these were a low risk, so we're letting them out, then the community might be more amenable to the idea that you're putting fewer people in jail.
So now that you have the scores, you know, you've gone through this risk assessment meeting where, you know, they're asking these questions that are kind of, it almost seems like the things they ask you after an interview, like you're screening for a job interview. So what do you do next after you've gone to Florida and you've kind of interviewed people a little bit?
So what we did first when we got the data was we did the very simple bar chart. Who's getting what score? We did a black and white, right? And we were like, the scores are 1 through 10. And the black chart was all exactly almost even in the sense that there were about the same number of people in each score bucket. But the white chart was crazy. Everybody was in the low bucket, and then there were barely any people in the high bucket. So our very, very first super simple analysis was like, huh, that's weird, right? But as we thought about it, we realized you can't actually draw a conclusion from that, because what if every single person who was white came in and actually, what if they were all Mother Teresa and that this is, they had just mistakenly parked their car wrong and they were truly the most low-risk people in the world and it was totally justified, this disparity. So we made the sad realization that we had to get more data, which was we had to go get everybody's criminal record and whether they committed any crimes after they were scored. So that was another 6 months of basically all these records are public, but we had to go to these websites and scrape the data, and then the website would time out and occasionally sometimes we would crash it.
And did you ever have to get any direct information from North Point?
So we knew through their public documents that we weren't going to be able to see the algorithm. And we also knew that the county itself, Broward County, could provide us access if they wanted to, but we asked them and there wasn't that much that they could share either. So we weren't sure until we finished our analysis what we would ask them, because we knew they couldn't tell us the score. That said, I did interview the founder of North Point early on in the reporting just to understand the history of the score. So he told me a little bit about the score and how he developed it and, you know, how it had evolved over time. And I asked him about racial bias and whether he thought there was any, and he said no, which is what their own studies also show. And then, you know, I told him I was testing it, but I think he was still shocked when I showed up with an actual analysis.
Let's rewind just a little bit. And you said that when you showed up and you were asking them about these risk scores and they said that they had no idea that they were using these in their courtrooms.
Right. Well, the judge knew. So I interviewed the judge and he was very funny. So he said to me, yeah, I used to use those scores, but I just realized after a while that my judgment was better. So I still get them, but I don't use them. I don't rely on them. So actually at that point I thought, well, shoot, maybe I don't have a story because maybe they are not being used here at all. And I was really depressed, actually. But then I realized it doesn't really matter because they're used for sentencing in Wisconsin, New York State, San Francisco, across the country. And so the fact that in Broward, where I was analyzing the data, that the judge said he didn't rely on them was not necessarily something that I had to be worried about. It was hard because I had entered this whole investigation with this idea that I wanted to show a really high stakes algorithm. And then it turned out that the algorithm I was analyzing, the place I was analyzing it, was sort of lower stakes. But it still has high stakes across the nation.
And as far as sentencing is concerned, do the algorithms tend to do a better job than judges or people just sentencing from other criteria?
There's no way to know how these algorithms perform at sentencing because they can't be tested. They're contained in these pre-sentencing investigation reports that are confidential. So those reports in almost every state are sealed. They're provided to the judge and provided to the prosecutor and the defense. The client themselves often doesn't even see it unless their lawyer shows it to them. And certainly a journalist cannot get a hold of these reports. So the problem I had was the places where the score was most impactful, where it was being used for sentencing, I couldn't get the data. So that's why I had to go to Broward County, where they were using it at pretrial, which is still a courtroom setting. So I felt like it was an early in the process situation, but where it wasn't sealed.
So you mentioned that, you know, a lot of times even the clients don't know that they have these scores. And I remember there was one point in your story where the guy was, he thought that his score was way too low based on, you know, his past history. When you saw that note or you found that little tidbit, what did you think?
Most people had never seen their score. So what happened was, once I had all these scores and figured out some good examples, I went and showed up at these people's door and knocked on their doors in Florida. And, you know, it was an awkward conversation. I'm here to tell you about a score that you never knew about that has been assigned to you. Some people really only open their doors a crack. And this guy was great, though. He immediately said that he didn't understand why he was a low score. He had just gotten out of 5 years of prison for felony drug trafficking, and he was a pretty frequent visitor to jail. He described to me their meal plan in great detail. He's very familiar with it. And he was a very nice guy, Jimmy Ravelli, and he's in his 50s, white guy, and he's led a life of crime. He said he's been addicted to drugs since he was 13. He's struggling to overcome it. He says he's been sober for several months now, but he definitely did not assess himself as low risk.
In those meetings where you're knocking on doors, were you ever threatened, or were there any, like, moments where you felt like uncomfortable?
I mean, I went to very sketchy neighborhoods, right? But my experience with very sketchy neighborhoods is that people were very nice. And this was exactly what happened in this situation, too. People would look at me and some people would say, "Do you know where you are?" And I say, "Yeah, I know where I am."
I found it interesting that just how bad those scores were at predicting future violent crime. It's like 20% of the time. And if I did anything wrong 80% of the time, you know,
You'd be fired.
If I did my work wrong 80% of the time, I wouldn't have a job anymore. And it's like,
right.
You know, we sit near each other and I wouldn't get to see you. So
right.
Whenever you guys did the analysis and you saw, man, this thing is usually wrong. What was going through your mind?
You know, it's funny because we weren't even necessarily sure we were going to calculate the violent recidivism score. The judge is given two scores, whether you're going to commit a crime in the future and whether you're going to commit a violent crime in the future. And so we had worked so hard to calculate whether this general recidivism score was correct that we kind of lost momentum and we were like exhausted. And so it wasn't until I think several weeks before the story ran that we were like, oh yeah, we were going to calculate that violent recidivism one. And when we looked at it, we actually couldn't believe our eyes. I made Jeff recalculate it four times. I was like, no, it can't be 20, only right 20%. That doesn't make sense. So then I ran the numbers myself because I didn't trust him. And I was like, wait, it says 20%. And then we ran it four more times. And Eric was there and he was like, I'm finding it a little disturbing what's happening here, because usually you don't come up with a finding this late in the story that is this significant. Yeah, we were chagrined because we'd calculated like five other metrics about the violent crime thing, but somehow hadn't done that one. And it is a shockingly low percentage.
When you found out that it was being used in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin had a couple cases where it was like, man, these are pretty extreme cases.
Yep.
Tell us one thing that you maybe wish you could have put in the story from either Wisconsin, from Broward, that you couldn't necessarily.
I went and spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, and I wish I could have put in more about how wholeheartedly they've embraced risk assessments from start to finish. So I went and spent a lot of time in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a county where they're using the risk assessments at every single stage. In fact, when you're arrested, before the officer decides whether to charge you, they do a risk assessment on the scene. It's a very short 5-question test. Yeah. And so this is basically designed to decide whether to even bring you into the system or not. And so the idea that this risk assessment had been embraced so wholeheartedly that it was already at the beginning of the system was so interesting to me. And I think that, once again, it's a very well-intentioned effort to remove bias, right? Obviously, police officers have a lot of discretion in who they arrest. And so if you make them do a little bit of an assessment, like, is this person ever been in trouble before? You know, what was the age they were first arrested at? What type of crime? They're very simple questions. Perhaps it would end up being more objective. But it also seemed like it raised this possibility of a cycle that you could never get out of. That once you were arrested, you would always score high risk on that and then get arrested again.
There was a judge who, after seeing somebody's risk assessment, gave him, you know, more years in prison, gave him a longer time. Were there more cases that you found that were similar to that?
Yeah, there are several cases like that. I wasn't able to go into all of them. But in Wisconsin, there's a case pending in the Supreme Court right now where a guy was given a high-risk score at sentencing. The judge gave him towards the higher end of the sentencing range and said, in part, it was due to his high-risk score. And that case is actually before the state Supreme Court right now. They're debating whether it's a denial of his due process rights. And to me, that's a really important question because it is a very important due process question. If you can't see how the score is made, and even if you could see actually how the score is made, you wouldn't necessarily know that it was biased unless you had done the analysis we did. So how do you introduce that as evidence and have a judge rely on it without a totally open courtroom discussion about it where the defendant can challenge that score? And so I'm really interested to see how that case plays out because there's an opportunity for the Supreme Court to demand a more adversarial process, which I think would be a real advantage because these scores are given in these sealed reports and there's very little opportunity to challenge them right now.
In the planning stages of the story, when you know you have the story set and you're in design meetings, when I'm scrolling through the story, I see these images and it's like every time you see another one, you get a little bit more upset. I know it's going to be him. He's going to be the guy or she's going to be the girl who has the higher risk score. How is that decision made to kind of include those in the story to kind of tell the broader story within the story?
Yeah, that's a great question. We worked really hard on finding these comparison cases because so many people we talked to internally and externally about the story said, okay, that's fine. You have all this math, you're telling me that it's biased, la la, right? But like, give me a case. Like, I need to sink my teeth into an actual reality. So what we did was we did actually like a full month of data analysis where we pulled people who had the similar charges. And then we looked for cases which had similar kind of facts, although they all are very, it's hard to get that too similar. But for instance, our lead is like two people who stole about $80 worth of stuff. So it was similar level of theft. And then we looked at people who got really high risk scores that didn't appear to be justified and people who got really low risk scores that didn't appear to be justified. And of course, those were also racially distributed. And so what we found was these comparisons were so evocative. Even I, when I read them, having already spent months on them, remain shocked that over and over again, somebody who's like a career criminal who's white is getting a low risk score, and somebody who's black and it's their first or second offense is getting a super high risk score. And seeing those examples, we realized was going to tell the story better than anything. In fact, we had this one joke at one point where we were like, maybe we should just only run those and then just let everybody figure out the math themselves. But we didn't do that. But it is actually true that those stories sort of are more compelling in a way than the math.
What do you hope that people understand about these algorithms? Is this something that can change? Like, shortly, is it something that you just, you know, you get rid of these algorithms and things get better? Or what do you hope that people get from this?
Okay, it's kind of a complicated hope because, honestly, I'm not arguing against the use of algorithms. I myself find that my decision-making capacity is limited, and if a machine can help me, that's, like, all the better. And I think as humans, we're all going to get better if we can expand our brains using computing power. And so I think that's a great goal. The thing I learned, though, from this analysis was that people were just looking at these algorithms if they were right, but they weren't looking at whether they were wrong. And so if you think about it, the finding we had was that this algorithm was right 60% of the time. Well, let's say that you just, given the structural inequality of our system, just decided to give every single black defendant a high-risk score. You might actually be right 60% of the time. Like, it might not be that different than the accuracy we just found. And so looking at the failure rates was actually what was more illuminating. So the idea was, okay, it's only right 60%, but what about the 40% who are getting the wrong scores who's getting the more damaging wrong score. And it is definitely more damaging to be labeled high risk incorrectly. And that's where we saw the racial disparity. And so what I would love is for the people who have these algorithms, build these algorithms across the country to test their scores against that metric. Because right now, that's not the metric that's being used. And I think that if everyone were to test their scores and see if they were biased, then you can have a more honest conversation about whether they're an improvement to the criminal justice system. And so I guess that's my sort of very wonky hope, is test your algorithm. Test where it's failing.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Julia.
It was so great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.